would you like to win a copy of one of my all-time favorite gardening books, Rodale's An Ultimate Encyclopedia of Organic Gardening? If you enter our 2015 Gardening Challenge by going to our website at awesomemontana.com and clicking on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener podcast, right on top, there's a link to the Gardening Challenge where you can fill out a simple form. It just asks your name, the number of people in your household, what vegetable, fruit, or flower you're choosing, how much you plan to grow, and where you live. Welcome to the Organic Gardener podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Beyer. Let's get growing. Welcome to the show today. I'm so excited to introduce my guest, Nancy Oliver. She has a great little blog called Little Homestead in Boise. And so she's living in Boise, Idaho. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Great. Thanks, Jackie. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. My husband and I live in Boise, Idaho. We're kind of in the main urban part of town. And we sort of have a little urban sort of thing going in the city. We basically have a standard-sized city lot, and there's just the two of us. Our three kids are grown and live in the area. We have one cat and three chickens, and basically have sort of worked over the years. We've been here about 10 years, our current house, to kind of develop a little urban homestead. We have fruit trees, perennial vegetable gardens, summer gardens because of the climate in Boise. It's very cold in the winter and very hot and dry in the summer. And now, so we just try to become more self-sufficient, do more organic gardening, and work with the weather.
What's your elevation in Boise?
We're actually, I think, kind of at sort of ground level. I think our elevation is probably just about 100 or 200 feet. We're a high desert climate surrounded by hills that go up to, I think, about 4,000 or 5,000 feet. And then farther out away from Boise, you get into the mountainous areas in southern Idaho.
Oh, okay. Wow. So almost right at sea level there then. So
yes.
But still it gets very cold in the winter, you say?
Yes, we're sort of a high desert climate, but sort of a mountainous desert climate. I think the coldest I've seen it here is a little bit below zero. And then this year we had actually a really mild winter, which was pretty odd. It was really cold in November. We hit a record low of 8 degrees with about 8 inches of snow on the ground. And then in early December, it was 62. So we had a pretty strange winter, but that's not typical. Usually it's freezing or below most of the winter, and then spring is usually about April or so, and then it's pretty hot usually by mid-June maybe, depending on the year or so.
Okay, so I always like to start the show by asking my guest about your very first gardening experience. Like, how old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? How'd it go?
Sure. You know, I thought about that a lot, and the one person who I think really got me hooked on gardening was my grandfather. I grew up in Southern California as a kid where it's, you know, really mild. You can garden almost all year round. I grew up outside of Los Angeles, a little city called Pomona, which I guess is now pretty big. But he was a really, really, he's what I would call a master gardener without the certificate. Mm-hmm. He had fruit trees and grapes, and he was in town. He had a standard city lot, standard little ranch house. And grew everything from, he had an avocado tree and a peach tree. He grew kumquats, which I didn't even know what they were until I was an adult, and grapes and strawberries, and had just an immaculate backyard and front yard, very weed-free. I don't think he was organic, but he loved to garden. I think it was kind of he had been in World War I and World War II, and I think for him it was very therapeutic. And he just loved to be outside and in all kinds of weather gardening and growing food. My grandmother was a real baker and canner and, you know, preserved foods and knitted and crocheted and sewed. But he was really the gardener of the two of them. And I loved spending weekends with my grandparents just to kind of see what he was up to. And I'd, you know, help him plant things and harvest things. So, but he really loved working in his yard, and that really rubbed off on me, I think.
Cool. Oh, that's really sweet. I like to hear that. Love spending weekends with my grandparents. That reminds me of when I was a kid and used to go spend weekends with my grandparents, although my grandmother didn't garden.
I think he was the heavy lifter of the two with that.
Oh, uh-huh. So tell us, what does organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening mean to you?
I look at it as trying to work as closely with nature as possible, given different variables. I think that, you know, it depends on how you're living, where you're living, what the climate is, what your particular challenges are.
Mm-hmm. And who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques?
I think that I'm in my late 50s, so I was kind of around, you know, I was a kid in the late 60s and 70s, where there was kind of the back-to-earth movement a little bit with what you could call, I guess, the hippie culture. Huh? And I think in the 70s, I started really looking at, you know, why are we using a lot of herbicides and pesticides? What's going into the groundwater? And as I became older and then eventually became a homeowner, I was looking at, you know, what can I do to sort of work with nature more, you know, use less water and mulch, use less herbicides and pesticides and use other alternatives, use, you know, different kinds of products or different natural ingredients that would reduce, you know, pests as well as weeds and any kind of noxious, you know, kind of things that were growing.
I'm glad you brought that up, too, because I think a lot of people, and especially, you know, Earth Day was just last month, and a lot of people don't realize there was a congressman, his name was Gaylord Nelson, and he created the first Earth Day event back in the 1970s. And, you know, and I think there was a kind of a big thing back then that we're kind of seeing the benefits of now, I think, as generations go. And with these millennials that are coming up, I really see promising things with them. They seem very socially conscious, you know, caring about the environment. You know, there's a lot of entrepreneurs amongst them, but they kind of have this, like, you know, we're going to be socially conscious about the businesses that we build. So I think that's paying off the people in the 60s and 70s
who are growing up. Sometimes, you know, sort of a few generations to kind of, you know, kick things into gear. I mean, I know my grandparents weren't organic, and then, you know, my parents weren't really, they were sort of old from Bath with that. And then with me, and now my kids are seeing that, who are adults, are kind of, you know, that's kind of normal for them to think about just doing things organically versus using any kind of, you know, chemicals and pesticides and things.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So then how did you learn how to garden organically?
You know, I subscribed to Mother Earth News way, way back when, I don't even remember when they first started publishing. And there was, I've read a lot of Rodale Press books over the years that, again, kind of really promoted a lot of organic gardening. And I've learned from going to nurseries and, you know, greenhouses and talking to other people. And, of course, now with the Internet, that's been a huge boon, I think, to anybody being able to do research pretty quickly and easily. And then it's a matter of filtering all that information through about what's maybe appropriate for me versus somebody else, and what's an authentic good piece of information to use versus something that's maybe not quite as accurate as it could be. And I also did become a master gardener through the University of Idaho Extension Office here in the Boise area. And so that was really helpful. I could also access information from them. That was probably about 10 years ago.
Now, do they promote organic gardening through that master program?
Not completely, and I actually don't really work with them anymore, because once I fulfilled sort of the volunteer part I did, I, you know, work with other people in different ways. But I don't necessarily know that they're, you know, pro organic totally, but I know that was part of what I was able to study with their program. Oh. And then they, for instance, also eventually started offering permaculture classes. Oh. I don't know if that's a national trend with the extension offices, but I know here in Boise they did offer some permaculture classes as well.
Huh. Oh, cool. Well, that's good to know. I guess our extension agent, we didn't get funded this year, so they're not even offering the master class in our county this year. But
funding sometimes.
Uh-huh. But good for you. And I've had a lot of people on that have taken those master gardener classes and just talk about how wonderful they are and how much they learn there. So it never occurred to me that they wouldn't be organic.
Well,
but
I
get this tunnel vision sometimes and think, well, I'm organic. I'm always surprised when I ask friends of mine, can you be on my show? No, I can't be on your show. Or I'm like, do you want to be on my show? And they're like, I can't be on your show. I'm not organic. And I just kind of look at them with this blank stare, like, really?
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that was one thing I brought up with you with your initial email was, you know, I'm going to be totally honest, I'm not 100% organic. I do as much as I can, but, you know, there are a couple small, teeny areas that I have to deal with things. And I think that's part of it, too, is it's also a process. You know, as time goes on, I find more better ways organically of dealing with things versus, you know, relying on chemicals or just, you know, an insane amount of weeding on my hands and knees.
Well, and, like, I never even realized, like, I always thought our chickens were organic, but then since I've had the podcast, I realized that I can't afford to buy them organic chicken food, so I guess technically they're not, you know, because we're feeding them just regular, you know, food from the store, so our eggs I couldn't. Somebody's like, why don't you sell your organic eggs? And I was like, I guess our chickens aren't organic. So, yeah, you know, I think we all do what we can do and try to do our best. So,
yeah, hey. I think that's true. I think, again, it's a process, and it's also just, you know, I always like the phrase bloom where you're planted. You know, you do as much as you can where you are with what you have to work with. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of in the same boat. You know, my chickens are not 100% organic just because, you know, there's things in the atmosphere I can't control. We're right near an easement, and so one of the irrigation districts comes through and spreads herbicides. And I know that that's somewhat leaching into our garden, and there's not a whole lot I can do about it. They've almost killed a couple of our fruit trees. Aww. And luckily I caught it really early, and I watered for 24 hours and was able to sort of flush it out of the system and dilute it a bit, you know, where it, at least it didn't kill our trees. And so there's some things you can't really control even with that. I mean, unless you have, you know, 50 acres of pristine farmland somewhere that's never been touched and nobody's around it. And even then, you know, there's stuff coming out of the air. So it's kind of a constant sort of reassessment of, you know, what your needs are and what you can do. I mean, I feed my chickens all local natural food from a local feed uh-huh. store. But it's not organic because I'm in the same boat of, well, you know, the chicken eggs are pretty much just for us. I sell a few to a coworkers, and I told them they're mostly organic. You know, it's like they get organic fruits and vegetables and things from, you know, scraps. But again, you know, it's hard to control all the variables sometimes, especially in an urban setting.
Yeah. All right. Well, so tell us about something that grew well this year in your garden.
Well, my cool weather crops are doing great. I've got a couple different kinds of kale and some collard greens. It's early in the growing season here, so we don't really have, you know, my normal hot weather vegetable garden is just getting started. I have tomatoes and peppers planted, but all of my perennial vines are coming up nice and fast. I've got blackberries coming up and raspberries and marionberries. So, but again, it's still kind of early. But my cool weather crops are doing great.
Last summer? I guess most of the people have still been talking about last year.
Yeah, last year we had a really great harvest of tomatoes and peppers most of the year. Peppers were down a little bit, and it was funny because everybody in the valley said that, so I don't know if there was something going on, maybe a lack of pollination or something, hard to tell. But and we had a really great fruit harvest. We have a nectarine tree, no apples last year for some reason, and we had a few pears off our brand-new baby pear tree. So.
Oh, fun. Now, a lot of people say peppers need like a warm soil. Was it warm in the spring when the seeds were, you know, young and when you first put the pepper, if you had plants that you just put out, could that have been it? Did you have like a cooler spring last year?
No, you know, it's really interesting. Peppers I usually actually buy small starts and planted them in June when it was nice and warm. We had a nice, normal, hot summer. Oh. Everything was, you know, well watered, well taken care of, and the plants got really big, but there were no peppers. It was really just kind of odd, you know. I do start some things from seeds, but tomatoes and peppers I usually buy starts. Mm-hmm. I have lots of little starts right now that are up of, we bought a little tiny, kind of like a little mini greenhouse seed starter that's about 5 feet high and probably 3 feet wide and 2 feet deep. And I have some nice big 4-inch baby green beans in there and basil and cilantro and a few other herbs. So far it's a little bit early for us, but my cool weather things are doing great.
Cool. All right. How about something that you're excited to do different this year or something that you're going to try new that you haven't done before? Anything like that?
Well, we're planting our first peach tree here. Our nectarine tree got a little bit damaged by the county coming through on our easement. So we're planting a peach tree, which will be nice. And I also planted some new heritage tomatoes that I hadn't seen before. Oh. We had a few varieties that one of our greenhouses had. We have an Anna Russian, an Arkansas Traveler, which has been around for a while, but I haven't planted. And then another one called a Japanese black trifle. I'm probably massacring that, but it's also called a Russian black truffle, Russian heirloom tomato. So I'm trying a few new varieties. So I'll be curious to see how they do.
Cool. Okay. How about something that didn't work so well last season? Was there something that didn't come out the way you thought it would?
Yeah, probably my peppers. Usually I love having lots of peppers over the summer. I grow a pretty good variety from things like bell peppers and jalapeno peppers and some of the longer gypsy type yellow peppers. So yeah, last year was kind of a no pepper kind of summer. They're great to grill, put on pizzas and things, but yeah, that one. And no apples. That was sad. We have a beautiful pippin apple tree that had zero apples on it. I think it was because we'd had it pruned, so it was one of those things, but it's loaded this year, so.
Oh, good. Okay. So it's loaded with, like, blooms this year? Or, I mean, you don't have apples coming on already, right?
Nope, not yet, but lots of blossoms. Actually, there are little teeny tiny apples on. We had a really early spring this year, so the fruit trees and things are probably at least 4 to 6 weeks ahead of time.
Oh, my goodness.
It was really, really warm in March, so we got sort of a really jump on the fruit tree season.
We have a lot more blooms, and we have one tree that Mike was saying has never bloomed before, and it bloomed, and I'm curious to know, I don't know if this could be, but like we got bees about a month ago. I think it was April 19th. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with it. He thinks it's the water. He's been giving them more water. They're kind of in a drier spot. We just dug a well last year, a deep well to water with, and he thinks it's the water that maybe.
Oh, that
so,
could be.
But
in the spring when things are really growing fast, if they have enough water, that's probably really helpful.
All right. How about something that you find is easy to grow and generally successful every time in your area?
Usually tomatoes and squash seem to just go gangbusters. I think they love the heat.
Oh, okay. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
You know, I've always really had trouble with carrots. I've just sort of given up. Carrots and radishes, I don't know why. And I think part of it is in the valley, there tends to be usually two types of soil. We either have really heavy clay soil that's really compacted, or people who live by the rivers tend to have really sandy soil that doesn't have a lot of nutrients. So I can, amend the soil and, add, tons of compost. But for some reason, I don't know, I'm just not real great with root vegetables. And here, Idaho is a potato state. That's one thing I just don't grow because I'm not a big potato fan. So.
Oh, funny. I was just thinking today, I wish I could grow sweet potatoes or yams. I just love them. We grow lots of potatoes, but I don't know if you can grow sweet potatoes or yams in our climate. I think they kind of like
sure
a warmer.
It might be more like an annual kind of thing that we could grow here maybe just in the summer.
Oh. How about which activity is your favorite activity to do in the garden?
You know, I just actually find it really relaxing in the summer to just water the vegetables, walk through in the flowers and things, and just it's my time to sort of inspect things too. You know, you're watering, you're looking to see any vegetables, that look damaged, or do I have bugs I need to deal with, or oh, I didn't see that there's a cucumber that's ripe under there.
Uh-huh.
So I really like when I'm sort of going out watering and checking things and sort of checking in with the garden, see what's going on.
And then on the flip side, how about your least favorite activity? Is there something you just got to force yourself to get out there and do that just kind of you don't like as much?
I think when it's over 100 degrees and I have to go out and weed, that's never any fun. That's where, you try to go out in the morning, but sometimes just depending on how life is going, sometimes you have to go work out in the heat of the day, and that's never a whole lot of fun.
Mm-mm. I just wilt in the hot, super hot anymore. I don't think I could do that. Okay. How about tell us about the best crop that you ever grew? Was there one year that something was just so prolific you didn't know what to do with all your produce and you just couldn't believe how big it was?
I think about 2 or 3 years ago, I had the biggest bumper crop of tomatoes I'd ever had. I literally was picking like 2 or 3 cups every day. I had kind of a range from the smaller cherry tomatoes to, I don't grow really huge tomato varieties because they tend to get ripe about October. So you have this really long stretch with nothing. And I just had, I don't know what happened, if it was the weather or we just hit it just right, but I just had a bumper crop. I was making, fresh salads with fresh basil and tomatoes and mozzarella cheese, or making homemade pizzas, or just slicing them onto salads. But we just had a bumper crop of tomatoes, and I really enjoyed it. And they're so good for you, too.
Right? And there's nothing like a homegrown tomato.
Oh, yeah.
How about, what's the best gardening advice you've ever received?
You know, that, I thought I had to think about that for a little while, too. I thought, really, I think it's kind of a two-pronged approach, which is make a plan and start small. I think that's really the best advice I'd give anybody is you can become so overwhelmed by trying to make a huge, monumental change all at once that you can become, I think, distracted, overloaded, overly tired, and broke. So I think, make a plan, start small. It's like when we bought our current house. We basically moved into a house that had one tree, turf, and all the flower beds were empty. It looked like they had probably used Roundup to kill everything. And, we couldn't afford to go out and fill up all the flower beds and create a huge extension vegetable garden and do everything at once. So we just focused on planting a tree, getting some perennial shrubs in, and then just starting small over a course of several years to kind of, and it took quite a while to fill things in. But I think that's a good one is, make a plan, start small, and I think to figure out what your priorities are.
You know, just lots of golden nuggets there for people and listeners to, I'm just going to pick some out to make sure that they're, you know, that you started with planting a tree, which is something that, you know, you put in and it's going to be there and it's going to produce fruit and it's going to produce fruit. Like, we planted an orchard in 2012 and I had no idea how many apples we would get and how much fruit we would be getting already. And this is only its third year. And then, and like I said, you know, last year's really the first year we could really even water it. So, you know, starting with a tree, something that's going to keep reproducing. It's not like starting with an annual crop, which for listeners is something you have to plant again every year. Then the next thing you mentioned were the perennial shrubs, which is another thing that's going to, they're going to expand and grow on their own. You don't have to replant them. So then your garden's really building, you know, more permanently. And I think that's a good, those are good suggestions for listeners if they're just starting out to, you know, go with some of those perennials that come back every year and are going to spread and grow and, you know, not get yourself overwhelmed in the beginning. And then also the part about planting it and figuring out what you do like, that's something I hear from a lot of guests too. Don't grow something if you don't like it just for the sake of growing. We all kind of get that bug. I know, like I went to Home Depot like in February and was like, came home with $75 worth of seeds or something crazy. And Mike's just like, what are you doing? And I was like, I don't know. I got excited, I guess. And just, you know, you go to the store and you buy all those starts or something. And then you get home and you're like, where am I going to put all this stuff? So I think really good advice. We all kind of get that little bug in us. How about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what would that be?
Years and years ago, I bought something called a Japanese digging tool. Oh. I think I've had that at least 20 years, maybe, and it's still going strong. It's basically a two-sided tool. There's a little, kind of like a little spade trowel on one side, and then the other side, there's three big prongs. So you can loosen the soil with the prongs. You can also dig with the other side. And it's just a really great hand tool that you can pull things, you can dig things, you can create rows, you can create furrows. And so it's one of those tools. If that's the only one I could take, I definitely would, because it's just a really great multi-purpose tool.
Nice. Okay, how about eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? That's like the thing I really struggle with. And I've been learning after talking on the show that I think I might just have to bite the bullet this year. But got any tips for like eating or harvesting? Like my biggest problem is always like the lettuce all comes on at once, or I have like this big crop of food all at one time. And I wash it. If I wash it, it goes soggy in the fridge. If I don't wash it, then, you know, then I have this lettuce sitting around that's not clean, or, you know, things like that. So got any suggestions for eating or harvesting fruit or vegetables on time?
You know, I've had that problem too. I work for a school district, and so I'm off for the summers, which is great. And it seems like every single year, all the apples get ripe and all the nectarines get ripe a week after school starts. So here I'm really busy, and all of a sudden I've got, you know, 200 pounds of nectarines to process. And so, you know, one of the things I do is I try to just watch things really closely. There was one year that I sort of bit the bullet and actually harvested my apples probably about a week or two early. They weren't quite completely ripe, but I had the time to deal with it. Uh-huh. And since most of them were going to be processed into applesauce, it didn't really matter too much anyway. And so it wasn't like I, you know, needed them to be perfectly ripe for canning slices or something. And so I think you just have to really keep an eye on things. And there have been times that I've had to change the way I preserve fruits, for instance. We bought a small chest freezer several years ago, and the first year I tried canning all the nectarines, and we had kind of a small harvest, so I was able to do that. And then the second year, there was no way. And so I canned as much as I could with the time I had, and then the rest of it I processed by freezing them. I basically, you know, peel them, slice them, I didn't peel them. It's one thing I love about nectarines. There's no fuzz. So right. I basically slice them and just dip them a little bit in a little bit of fruit fresh so they wouldn't turn brown in water, and then package them up in gallon bags and put them all in the freezer nice and flat, and they were great. They lasted a year, and it was a lot faster way for me to preserve at least part of the harvest. So yeah, vegetables, I've never had really too much time because I don't tend to overplant those. Uh-huh. So it's been more the fruit trees. You know, when it gets ripe, a lot of time it all gets ripe at once. So I just keep an eye on it and try to have a backup plan. There was one year we had a bumper crop of apples, and one of our in-laws, they had lost all their fruit harvest on their trees from frost. So I gave them about five gallon buckets of apples just to kind of share the harvest because they didn't have any.
Nice. No, I like frozen fruit. Sometimes that's like a convenient way to have it too, right? I think
oh,
like
sure.
frozen nectarines in your freezer, if you had to buy those, can you imagine the expense? And just I think that
and it's great.
They're kind of easy
in the
to
winter,
use that way. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, in the winter I made cobblers. I've you know thawed them out and used them in smoothies. So yeah, any kind of fresh frozen fruit, if you don't have the time to can it, or at least you can freeze part of it, it's a really great thing to have over the course of the winter. You can make breads and cobblers and all kinds of things with any kind of fresh fruit.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because like I've been talking a lot on the show about the new green smoothie movement. I'm going to try to grow kale this year, but then I decided that I didn't really like green smoothies because I didn't want to put vegetables in my blender. And but I do love fruit smoothies with yogurt, and I'm not a big fruit eater, so like I kind of have to almost force myself to eat fruit, and so that's a good way for me to get my fruit in. So homemade frozen nectarines would be a big hit at my house. For the winter to have, because frozen fruit to buy to put in smoothies with like yogurt and everybody's always like you should eat hemp protein, so I try to put that in there, but I don't know about.
Somebody told me about hemp protein this spring because I actually can't do a lot of dairy. I have a little bit of a dairy allergy, and so I have been using yogurt or milk, and then almond milk can be kind of bland with just a little fruit. But I started putting in some organic toasted coconut and hemp protein, and I was able to eat that with just a little bit of fruit juice and then fresh fruits, and gives you the kind of the benefits of coconut, a little bit of the hemp protein instead of using dairy for protein. So that was a good blend for me. I just thought of something too when you were talking about preserving food on time. One of the things I started doing more too the last year or two is fermenting. So one of the things I was thinking I had done in the winter, I had bought some store-bought organic kale, and I had found a nice little recipe for fermenting kale with carrot slices and some other dark green leafy vegetables and fermenting those. And then you can serve those as a little side dish with meals. So sometimes fermenting is a good option, too, for people if you have a lot of food coming on quickly that you need to preserve. You can preserve and by fermenting all kinds of vegetables.
Now, tell us what you mean by fermenting. How do you do that?
I know fermenting, there's a few different ways to do it. I do a lot of the fermenting that is just basically just water and salt, and then you can also put in herbs or spices for flavoring. And then some people use fermenting crocks. I actually bought one, and I'm not going to plug any company, but there's several cultured foods websites that are out that sell supplies. So I, for instance, have a glass jar with a little airlock that you fill with water, and then you put your vegetables and your brine in and basically put the cap on. And what it does is it allows any of the gases to go out without having any bacteria contaminations going in. So your fermented food ferments pretty quickly and easily over the course of a week or two, depending on what you're doing. And then basically you just take the product out, put it in just a regular jar for storage, and stick it in your fridge.
Oh, neat. All right, I'm going to have to try that. That sounds good. Especially I like mixing herbs in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really great for your stomach.
Somebody gave me like some fermented, not coleslaw, it was sauerkraut, I think, to use like that, right?
I'm going to try that soon, too. I did actually make my first fermented pickles last year, and that was really different because if you're used to canned pickles and vinegar, you have that really strong vinegar flavor, but I was able to ferment some, regular little pickling cucumbers in a fermented brine, and it was a different flavor, but I really enjoyed it. They're slightly sour, so instead of getting that acidy vinegar flavor, you get more of a sour flavor, but you can season them just like regular pickles. You know, you can put in pickling spice mix and garlic and whatever you like. But I love pickles. I'll have to do that again this summer. Fermented pickles.
All right. One of my guests that's going to be on next week was talking about making pickled rhubarb. I thought that sounded good and like something to try. So I wonder if that would work. How about, do you have any special techniques for cooking weird or unusual foods?
You know, I can't really think of anything that's weird, but I think that just depends on what people are used to eating. I've always loved a lot of ethnic foods, even since I was a little kid. And so, for me, I don't know, weird or unusual, I'm not quite sure what that would actually be for me, because I eat a lot of different things. So, I don't know, I think the weirdest food I've ever grown were tomatillos, but a lot of people grow those for salsas and things, so I don't know if that's really a weird food. They just look kind of different, because they have a husk on the outside. But then you can just basically blend them or chop them or puree them into green salsas and things.
I was wondering if you had a recipe for the kumquats.
Oh, you know, that was one of those Southern California foods. Yeah. You know, and it was funny, we just ate them. And because the they're a really little teeny tiny citrus fruit that has a kind of a bitter juice, at least his was, but the peels were really sweet. So we would actually eat the outside of the fruit and then, you know, toss the rest for the birds.
Cool. Okay. How about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
I think my all-time favorite is probably pizzas. I love to just, there's a pizzeria that's locally up the street from me, and they sell their dough. So I can get a really nice kind of artisan dough, you know, a nice ball of dough for $2, and roll it all out nice and thin, and get fresh tomatoes from the garden, fresh basil from the garden, and herbs, and maybe a little cheese on top, and bake it. And that's just such a great, you know, dinner on a hot day, even if I have to heat up the oven, because the tomatoes just sort of almost melt, because they're so fresh and ripe.
Yum. Oh, that sounds perfect. I'm totally jealous. Pizza dough for $2.
Yeah, well, you know, or you can make your own. But it's you know, when you have one of those days where you're just running and running errands and busy, you know, grab a ball of dough on the way home, you know, stretch it out on the pan on the counter, let it warm up, and, you know, slather it with tomatoes, and you're good to go.
Nice. How about a favorite internet resource?
For gardening? Yeah, that's kind of a tough one. You know, I think there's so many resources out there now. I think really any kind of Mother Earth News, I know, a great resource. I get into their database periodically to look things up. A lot of, too, the nurseries that have organic sections, a lot of times if you can find a knowledgeable salesperson who can point you in the direction of organic products, for instance, that's really helpful. So I use a combination of things, I guess.
Nice. I like that. And that's good to hear that the nurseries are getting more organic things in them. And there were, I mean, Home Depot had like a ton of organic seeds this year that I was surprised. Now, the potting soil I brought home for Mike that said organic, there was only one I bought four different bags and there was only one that he would use. And the others all had, I can't remember what the ingredient was, but there was one that he was like, nope, this, I don't know what this is, but I don't think it's good. And he didn't want to try it, so.
Yeah.
You got to kind of buyer beware, right?
Yeah, that's true.
How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine? You mentioned Mother Earth News and Rodale's. Is there a book that you really like?
There's, you know, I'm kind of, it's kind of funny, as much as I love books, I tend to do more online reading sometimes than otherwise.
Sure, or you know, a blog kind of, or something.
Right. There's a lot of urban homesteading blogs that I follow. There's, I was trying to think of anything specific off the top of my head, I guess. It just kind of depends, too, on what I'm looking for, but it depends on if you're talking strictly organic gardening or if you're talking strictly just gardening in general. So I think I'm kind of an eclectic information person. I think I gather information from quite a few places. I have subscribed to Grit magazine. I found that was helpful with kind of ideas for maybe a little bit different types of gardening than I was familiar with. And xeriscaping, which is dry gardening, is one of those things. I found a lot of great resources through I think the city of Albuquerque and Santa Fe and Tucson, Arizona have had really great water saving tips for growing in hot, dry climates like we have here in Boise. So, because they've been doing it for a long time.
Okay, cool. I'll try to look up some of those resources and put them in the show notes then. How about, now you don't really have a business, right? You have your website.
Right, I have the blog. And I don't really sell anything through that. You know, I'm kind of on a back burner of thinking about maybe putting together some kind of a small ebook, but I think that's probably a little ways out. Yeah, the only thing I really sell are my extra eggs. That's about it. So,
got any tips for someone who wants to sell some extra eggs? I was just trying to get rid of some eggs today.
Sure. You know, start with people you know, and I think depending on where you live too, there are food banks that will take those also. So if you really are at the point where you know, you're throwing eggs away, you know, for some reason, that might be a resource, but I think it depends on where you live and what their rules are. I think that, you know, I also look at, too, there's so many different kinds of things you can make with eggs, from, you know, angel food cakes, which to me are particularly addicting with fresh egg whites. They're so good. They don't taste like anything store-bought I'd ever had.
Right.
You know, from omelets to, you know, whatever you can think of with eggs. But, you know, I think if you can start off, I mean, I sell some to a coworker. I happened to mention to her at one point, and she was thrilled, and so every week I take her in a dozen eggs, and she pays me, and that helps offset my chicken feed prices.
You know, that's exactly what I was thinking, was that, you know, well, for one thing, so they just started this Eureka-free Facebook page, website, kind of, you know, it's like the garage sale site, but it's for like free stuff to give away. And the very first day I get on it, what do I find? But 9 free chickens. And we were just down to our last chicken. So now all of a sudden we have 10 chickens, and I have just, my refrigerator is full of eggs that we are at the point where they're like, I can't fit them in the fridge. They're like sitting on the counter. Like, I just can't handle all these eggs. So last night I came home like, I'm going to get on the free website and just say, you know, if somebody wants to meet me, come get these eggs, you know, and try to give them away. And sure enough, one of the first things somebody said was the food pantry will take them. So, great idea there. I know. Well, usually Mike makes the most delicious macaroons, and, you know, those use egg whites. And then the bonus to that is then he makes homemade noodles with the egg yolks. But he's just so busy right now. He hasn't had time to do any of that. So,
Macaroons are one of those things I'd like to master. I haven't tried them yet. I think I'm too intimidated.
One thing that I found that makes them a much more, you know, tender or like moist or I don't know, but a better macaroon is buying the unsweetened coconut from the health food store instead of the, you know, regular coconut that you would normally buy at the grocery store. And to me, that makes all the difference in the world.
So interesting.
Just the unsweetened, unprocessed coconut from the health food store. And I think it's usually cheaper.
I did want to mention something I just thought of too. On my blog, there's actually a little list on my sidebar of different blogs that I follow. So if people were wanting to see sort of what I read, you know, what I can get resources from, they could check out the list of like my favorite blogs, because there's quite a few of them. I think there's maybe 10 or 15. But those are ones too, again, some people that are either homesteading in a rural area or also doing something similar to what I'm doing.
Okay. And I'll put the links to that in the show notes. And your blog is called The Little Homestead in Boise, right?
Yes, that's me.
And I'll put the direct link to the resources on the show notes page too. Okay. Well, we're up to the final question already. And that is a big one. So it goes, if there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either in your local area or on a national or global scale?
You know, I think the one thing that just really keeps coming up for me is water usage. Mm-hmm. You know, with the drought in the West that's happening, and that's affected the mountain areas also in the state of Idaho, I think that there's really got to be a major cultural shift in how people view water usage. You know, when you have people in drought states that are really stricken and farmers who are not growing food anymore because people are watering lawns, we're wasting so much water, and people are not encouraged to actually have water barrels and rain barrels to accumulate some of their own water that's coming out, and there are actually some Western states that have laws against that, I think that there's a real problem. And so I think that, you know, when people get to the point where they can't buy food or food is too expensive because not as many farmers are planting crops, then that may be what it's going to take for people to kind of wake up.
There's states that say you can't have a rain barrel and collect rainwater?
Yes. I think I read parts of Colorado. I can't remember if it's also Arizona and New Mexico. There are state mandates where if the water falls out of the sky on your property, you're legally not allowed to collect it because it's considered to be water that's going to go back into the groundwater, which, again, a lot of that is controlled by water permits with farmers and ranchers and the state who are then using those water resources and doling them out and charging fees for that. I read years ago that there's only about seven companies in the entire world that own all the water rights in all the countries in the world. And that's pretty scary. It's like there's a French company that owns the water rights in the state of Idaho for a lot of the big water companies. And that's not unusual. You know, and we have companies in California that have springs that are selling bottled water. Well, that water is coming from under the ground, and who knows what those springs are attached to. And so it's one of these things of, they're used to, I guess, from what I read in California, there were no state laws regulating how many people could drill how many water wells and how much water they could suck out of the ground. And now California is trying to, you know, spin its wheels faster and find out how to fix that.
Yeah. That's crazy. Because
you have to
companies
have water. I mean, water's just one of those things you have to have, you know, to grow food, you have to have to survive. And when areas are becoming more and more arid, we really need to look at some major cultural shifts from, you know, the well, we've always watered our lawn and we've always had sprinklers running into the streets and nobody really cares about that, versus we need to really look at consumption and, you know, appropriate allocation of water for food, for farming, because if we go to the grocery stores and there's no fresh produce, that's going to be a real big problem real fast. Mm-hmm.
I interviewed a woman this morning that runs an aquaponics business in California. And then I had a girl on last week, Maribou Latour, who has a podcast called Visionary Aquaponics. And so that's their big concern, is working on water. Well, especially the woman this morning from the Genesis Clock Farm, who lives in California where there is the drought. And the efficiency with aquaponics, which to me just seems so contradictory, because I keep thinking aquaponics must take a ton of water, but I guess it only uses a very small percentage, less than 90% of the water you would use normally, 2% of water as compared to what you would normally use to water the same amount of vegetables on a organic farm or in dirt. And so that, might be a solution we end up turning to a little bit more. I don't know. I'm curious to see how it all pans out, but they're growing quite a bit. And Maribou's down in Santa Fe, where they have the drought too.
Yeah, and that may be kind of one of the waves of the future is looking at different kinds of farming. I mean, one of the things I look at in Idaho are people that are growing, traditional crops that they've always grown. But if you have a state that's moving toward becoming more and more dry, then maybe shouldn't you start growing other things? Mm-hmm. Just because Idaho's always grown potatoes or always grown wheat or corn or whatever. Well, what if we start looking at crops that use less water? That would still have a good market, that farmers could still make money, mm-hmm. and start converting toward those. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a matter, too, of just, education. And, mm-hmm. and people sometimes have to be brutally honest and say, well, just because my father grew this 50 or 100 years ago doesn't mean I can still grow that.
Right, exactly. That's a good point. And then the other one I always hear is people say, I'm not going to buy organic food. It's just a ripoff. We didn't, we grew our whole lives. We never had to have organic food. And I think they just have no concept of how agriculture's changed, how many chemicals they've been dumping in our food since the 70s. And, the changes in the produce that you buy at the store and what they, what you're buying today is not what you were buying at the grocery store back then. So
yeah, I mean, that's really true. I mean, I was thinking the other day, I saw a show that was saying, this muffin that you buy today is not your grandma's muffin. That, back in the 20s, 30s, when my grandparents were alive, basically they were growing organic. There weren't real GMO products. Mm-hmm. There was no, huge application of chemicals and things. They were using, manure, and they were tending things and hand weeding, and it was all done more, kind of subsistence farming was done like that, versus now where every, a lot of farmers say, well, we've been spraying the land for 50 years and that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. If you could see me, I'm nodding with everything you say. All right, Nancy. So do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into that dirt and start their own garden?
Sure. I think, I really, again, that little phrase of bloom where you're planted, I think just, you can always start small. I have one daughter who has a little teeny tiny balcony in her little teeny tiny apartment, and she's growing a few herbs and a little tomato plant. And, you can start small by growing things in pots. You can grow things indoors, even if you have a nice sunny spot. You can grow things in any kind of a city yard. Even for people I know that have to deal with HOAs, which I'm not one of those, a homeowners association, I think even those nationally, there's a trend where more people are growing more food in their yards, and that it's okay to fight city hall if you need to be able to, feed yourself. So I think, start small, do what you can where you are, and just, go grow something.
Did you see that video about that guy in California who grew, there was like a little plot of dirt in front of his sidewalk and he put carrots in there and he won the case eventually, but at first they tried to fine him for growing carrots right in front of his house or something. I don't know.
No, but that doesn't surprise me, because I've seen some other cases like that. Uh-huh. There was one back east where a woman put some really nice, beautiful designed raised beds in her front yard, and her homeowners association sued her. She started a Facebook page, and she eventually won, because it was one of those things where, turf was sort of what was accepted to be grown in the front yard, and she, bucked the mainstream. And I think it's kind of like with keeping chickens, that things are changing nationally where people want to have that sense of food security. Mm-hmm. I know exactly what my chickens eat because I feed them. I know exactly what's in those eggs. I know exactly what I'm growing, in my little lot, and what went into it, and what's coming out of it. And so I think it's just a big national trend. And I think that's good. I think that people need to, you know, stand up for their rights. And certainly in the city, for instance, I can't have roosters. My neighbors wouldn't appreciate that. I know there are a few people in the neighborhood that do because I hear them, but I'm not going to turn them in. And so, you know, I think you just kind of do what you can where you can. And, you know, maybe someday I'll live in more of a rural area, we'll have a little bit more room. But for now, you know, I just do what I can, you know, when I can, where I can. And I did just encourage people to. It's really therapeutic. It's really great to dig in the dirt and grow something. And even if you fail a few times, you know, keep at it and keep trying.
Beautiful. Oh, I love it. Okay, so I'm going to put the link to your blog in the show notes. Is there any other way for people to connect with you? Or just have them go there?
You know, I don't really have a Facebook page for my blog because it was one of those things that I just wasn't really wanting to give Facebook all the access to all my content. Uh-huh. So that's the best way to get in touch with me. There's also a link they can contact me if there's any questions they want to email me or any resources they'd like. And certainly if anybody wants to post any comments on my blog to anything I'm posting, feel free to post any questions and I'll make sure and answer those for them.
Oh, I like that. Okay. Well, Nancy, thanks so much for sharing your expertise and your knowledge and just everything that you've shared with us today. And just good luck with everything in school. School's probably just about to get out, right?
Yep, we're out of school here another week and a half. I'm counting the days.
Oh, all right. Well, congratulations.
I'll be in my garden. So.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
thank you for having
summer.
Me, Jackie. It was really great to talk to you.
Oh, thanks, Nancy. How would you like to win a copy of one of my all-time favorite gardening books, Rodale's An Ultimate Encyclopedia of Organic Gardening? If you enter our 2015 Gardening Challenge by going to our website at awesomemontana.com and clicking on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener podcast, right on top, there's a link to the Gardening Challenge where you can fill out a simple form. It just asks your name, the number of people in your household, what vegetable, fruit, or flower you're choosing, how much you plan to grow, and where you live. You can always email me at organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com. There's no spaces, all lowercase, organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com. And just send me the information there too. Our goal is to help listeners be inspired to grow enough produce to feed your household for a year, or at least, you know, supplement your produce bill a little. So since our first challenge this year, we're just encouraging you to pick one fruit, a vegetable, or a flower, just one, that you would like to grow enough of for your household for 2 to 3 months, like for a season. Since it's a little late, we thought just, you know, 2 months. If you pick lettuce, you might, you know, it always depends. So something that you want to grow, 2 or 3 months worth, you know, kind of figure out how much would you buy if you went to the store? Would you buy a 2-pound bag of carrots every week? Or would you buy, you know, a 10-pound bag of potatoes every couple of weeks? Or, you know, if you're picking flowers, you might think about, you know, a bouquet. You know, what do you want? Like enough carrots to feed you and your kids, or enough salad to have to eat every day for the month of July, or, you know, enough zinnias to have a fresh bouquet or two on your table each week. You know, whatever it is that you'd like to grow for a season, let us know and you'll be entered to win a copy of Rodale's Ultimate Encyclopedia of Gardening. And then I just want to encourage you, if there's anything we can do to help make your garden journey easier, more successful, if you have any questions, if you just want to share your challenges or successes, we would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback for the show, somebody, a guest you'd like to hear from, or a topic you want to learn more about, you know, please, you know, let me know. Any honest suggestions that we can implement are always appreciated. Just, you know, let us know. Who are you? How do you like the show? You know, what can we do? We'd love to hear from you. Again, you can always email me at organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com, or just reach out to the contact form on the website. Thank you so much for listening to the Organic Garden Podcast today. Remember to